Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
When did the Children's Television Workshop get its start? Was there any children's programming prior to that name? You know, with public broadcasting?
I don't know. The answer to your second question. I don't know whether there was CPB children's programming before CTW came on the scene, but this fall we will begin our 10th season of Sesame Street. But prior to the airing of our shows, all of them, Sesame Street, The Electric Company, Feeling Good, the new series that just aired this fall, Best of Families, which is a history series for adults and adolescents. Prior to each of these programs being aired, there's a lot of research that's done. So about 2 years of research preceded the airing of Sesame Street. We have a new series that is to be aired in the fall of 79, a science series for children, I guess, 8, 10 years old, 4th through 6th grade, something like that. And we're in the process now of assessing how science is being taught in public schools and what kinds of things would assist teachers in that effort.
So when did you start with the children television?
Well, I've been with CTW for 9 years, and my role is unique to television in that prior to Sesame Street and Children's Television Workshop's programming, there was no such thing as a utilization expert or a person that was hired to reinforce learning objectives of a television show. Mm-hmm. That just didn't exist.
There was no
preparation and anticipation of, nor anything done to follow up and reinforce. What we've done is establish regional offices all over the country. And the role of those offices is to take the learning objectives of our shows and to see that those objectives are, that they are, how would you say, that they would that they would be incorporated into the lifestyles of the children that we're dealing with. Sesame Street's designed to act as an equalizer with disadvantaged children. We know certain things about children that are successful in school, and our research has demonstrated to us certain things that are missing among children that are not successful in school. And what we're trying to do is to bridge that gap between those two groups of children. Initially, we were concerned primarily with economically deprived children, because that's, you know, where our perspective was. We were saying that, okay, it seems that there is a pattern of success or failure in school that we can track based on a person's level of economic deprivation. But in the course of our utilization effort, our field services offices, the kinds of activities we've been involved in, our definition of deprivation has expanded considerably. We're still concerned with a deprived or disadvantaged child. It's just that when we say that, we mean a lot more. So it's kind of a word game and a little bit of semantics. Was it Hayakawa says cow one is not cow two or something like that? Well, you know, initially when I said deprivation, you know, I immediately said poor, you know, associated with poverty. But now I perceive deprivation in much broader terms, like, for example, a youngster that has a learning disability.
This will pick up that typewriter.
Okay.
Go ahead.
A youngster that has a learning disability. For example, a deaf youngster is deprived because of our society's inability to receive him within the mainstream of our society. Our society's lack of willingness, indifference, whatever, to include him in some way. So that youngster's deprived. His parents can be rich, but he's deprived. Mm-hmm. Same thing's true of a blind youngster. Same thing's true of a youngster that is physically or mentally handicapped, mentally slow, whatever. That youngster is going to be severely affected by the stigma associated with his handicap. When I say deprivation, I also visualize children that cannot communicate in English as being deprived. I also include children that come from middle-class families who have not or who do not receive attention, the reinforcement they need to feel their sense of self-esteem. We have programs that we've developed to reach and relate to these children, which assists the television show Sesame Street to make these our learning objectives happen with those children, because we've now expanded to include them. So we have projects that our field services offices get very involved in. But on the shows themselves, they have expanded from, for example, Sesame Street has expanded from being a show that was basically designed for Black and Chicano children, or children of very low income communities, to being a program that includes Spanish, because of our bilingual and bicultural objectives, because we know some things about children that have been told or programmed to believe there's something wrong with being different. And we're saying there's something really neat about being what you are. And in the process of reinforcing what they are, we're hoping that they will learn English without abandoning their basic, you know, cultural base. We have things on our programs on the television show. We have special segments that include physically handicapped children. We have the first 20 minutes of our Wednesday show is devoted to the mentally retarded. We have some hard set objectives to reach those children, particularly.
Kind of a new feeling free program is doing now solely?
I'm not familiar with that program.
Well, I should have brought the clipping along.
No.
It was just a recent spread in the TV Guide about feeling.
No, I'm not familiar with that. But the thing about what we're doing on the Wednesday shows is we are including the mentally retarded child on the street, just as other children would be on the street typically. And this is to serve a twofold purpose. You know, we live in a very segregated society, and not just segregated across, you know, color lines or segregated across economic lines, you know, the other side of the track kind of thing. But we're very segregated in terms of where do we place our elderly, you know, where do we place our physically handicapped children, you know, physically handicapped adults. You can virtually live out your life without encountering any of these people, you know, if you live in an urban center.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's unreal because certainly all of us have something wrong with us. You know, I wear glasses. I'm a little hard of hearing. You wear glasses. You know, that's a physical deformity. You know, we're fortunate that we do not have an extreme. You know, you have all your limbs and all. But it doesn't make you any less of a person. But when you do not see yourself, when you cannot see yourself included in the mainstream of society, you know, there's no way that you can feel any other way than there's something more wrong with you than what your handicap represents. As a black person, it is something that I'm, an issue that I think I'm particularly sensitive to, because I have felt the invisibleness of being black in our society. And now when I see the increased visibility, I look at my children and their level of sophistication, and I know that's come from seeing black people in power, seeing black people function in very natural ways.
Which is still something rather new.
Yeah.
It really is.
I mean, the first time.
It seems just as though years ago, a few years ago, I was at the preview house, and one of the questions that were, you know, the preview house, Sunset there, where they one of the questions was, how do you feel, this was when cigarette commercials were still popular on TV, how do you feel about this black man being in this commercial? You know, I mean, that was one of the, it just seems as though, gosh, it was not that many years ago.
The first time I saw black people in a Scott toilet paper ad, I said, my God. I mean, I got on the phone. It was the first time on television that they had used someone black in a commercial. And I got on the phone and called friends of mine and said, would you believe they're admitting that we use toilet paper?
Yeah.
And the excuse had been that, one, that white people would not be receptive to a product that utilized black people in the ads, and two, that black people did not reflect a sufficient number in terms of the market, the marketing of these products. What is interesting now for me to note is that every beer commercial on television, without exception, you know, have black people. All the McDonald's ads, all the Burger King's ads. So evidently, now I'm beginning to wonder, is this saying that most of the beer in this country and most of the fast foods in this country are consumed by black people? I don't know. And I wonder when you look at this, but what the greatest crime that anybody can perpetrate on another human being is not to call them a name. You know, it's not to call me nigger, but not to call me at all. That has to be the worst.
Call you a person.
To absolutely say I do not exist. You know, one of the most, I think, difficult thing had to be for black people that have served as servants in homes is that white people would literally do anything in front of them. It was like they were not there. I mean, they would have take off their clothes and dress, get in bed, make love. It did not matter. You know, they would not have done it in front of any other human being, but they just decided they didn't exist. So it's with this kind of head that I personally really felt some sensitivity when I talked to parents and teachers that said, You know, the world of Sesame Street is so perfect. And we have children that have physical deformities. And they look at the show and they don't feel like it's addressing itself to them. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're not in it. There's nobody sitting, even a person with a broken leg. And it was something I thought, well, gee, I never thought about it. You know, I've had the good fortune of having three very whole, healthy, bright, sharp, handsome children. And to stop and think that's not real. You know, most of us are not perfect. And yet we're presenting this very perfect world. And of course, our primary objective is to address ourselves to children that are typically left out and whose needs are not being met by anybody else. So it was perfectly natural for us to move in this direction. And with the input from parents and teachers and educators, you know, all around, that we were able to develop these segments where these children are now part of the street, and materials and information that goes out to parents that are available for parents and teachers to utilize in reinforcing learning among mentally retarded children, or activities for the physically handicapped, adapting reinforcement activities that would typically be done with children to the needs of those children. We have expanded, as I said, about in terms of the things on the show, and then always as a companion to or complement to those things on the show. Sometimes it's preceded the activity on the show. We were doing things with physically handicapped children in our community ed services, you know, through community ed services prior to them being included on the show. So sometimes we can't figure out which came first, the chicken or the egg. But we have a project now. We have all kinds of projects, but one that is my particular favorite. Giving you the spectrum of how we consider deprivation. We have a project that we're doing in federal prisons around the country where we have trained the inmates to be Sesame Street Electric Company tutors with the children that visit those institutions. And the reason or the premise being that no matter what a person's economic station, if your parents, one or more of your parents are incarcerated, there is a significant stigma in our society that's going to be attached to that, and you're going to have some problems. So we're concerned with what happens in that youngster's head, you know, that has that kind of situation. What kind of environment does he have when he is relating to or with his parents? You know, is it a positive one? And what we've tried to do through training the inmates and conducting orientation and sensitivity sessions with the prison staff people, the inmates themselves, is to create a situation which would be conducive to maintaining and strengthening family ties. If you can imagine a big empty kind of room with chairs and linoleum floors, and very live, you know, very sensitive to sound. And a mother comes in with three or four children. Another mother comes in with three or four children. And many, many other mothers come in with two to three children, some of them babies in arms, up until maybe 10 or 11 years old. But many 2 and 3 year olds that, well, you know, it only takes one of them to to raise a riot. And just what happens within a family unit in terms of kids squabbling. Now, if you've got all these families there, and they're sometimes there for 6 and 7 hours a given day, just sitting in this room. There's nothing else for them to do. There might have been a television set in the corner of the room, and that was it. And the mother's trying to talk to the father about, you know, very definite, you know, problems. You know, if you're there at home with 3 or 4 children by yourself trying to cope with all the typical things that families have to cope with, but by yourself, that when you do come together with your mate, you're going to want to talk about these things. Well, they couldn't really do that because the kids were fighting and they were pulling on the children. And they're fighting with the other family's children. And maybe there was an argument between them. And then the guard is saying, if you don't get those kids together, we're going to terminate your visit. So it was all around negative environment. So what was happening with the children, they were coming into this. So they associated all these negatives with their parents, you know, when their parents had an opportunity to talk. So they didn't see anything.
Which creates one more problem to the problem.
Right. So that project is one that is really super. We have, in the West, we have two projects at Lompoc Prison up in near Santa Barbara. We have another one that's going to be beginning in Terminal Island, another one in Safford, in Arizona. I've been doing the Watergate tour. I've seen Ehrlichman at Safford and Halderman at Lompoc.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of interesting. But that's just one sample of some of the kinds of things that we get into when we stretch out in terms of thinking about what is deprived. What is it that would hold you back? If, you know, in our society, it is not a negative to come to this country and speak Dutch or French, but it is to speak Spanish because there's a stigma and has been because of the menial roles that Spanish-speaking people have had, you know, in terms of the jobs and things like that. And all the things that have just been associated, stereotypes and things, that have been associated with Spanish-speaking people. So that when a youngster comes in a classroom and speaks no English, only speaks Spanish, the teacher has a very negative attitude. Mm-hmm. Little flags go up, you know. Youngster comes in, speaks only French, not a word of English. Teacher doesn't have to speak French. The teacher may take the child up and down the hall and show him off to the other children. Isn't this cute? I've got a little French child in my classroom. When you tell a person there is something wrong with doing the thing that is most natural to them to do, depending upon where they are, but we're talking about a young child, what you're in essence saying, there's something wrong with you. There is something wrong with you. There is something for you to be ashamed of. There's something for you to be embarrassed about. So that means you're a little bit ashamed of your parents, or maybe a lot ashamed of them. You're certainly ashamed of your inability to articulate in English. Those children suffer, you know, tremendously in the schools. So the inclusion of Spanish on our shows is an effort to build their self-esteem, to help other non-Spanish-speaking children to understand that Spanish is a language. And see, they don't always view it like that. They think in terms it's just gibberish.
Now, on a program like Sesame Street, there's just so many different groups that are combined into one program. I mean, there's so many different companies, cartoon companies and such. Do you have any idea, has it ever been figured out how much it costs to put the average Sesame Street episode together?
Yeah, I do know.
Because I wanted to compare it to the to the average network program, you know, like...
I think we figured, I think it's about less than a penny or two per viewer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But there are some... There are some cost breakdown. I don't have those figures.
Yeah, I'd like to show that.
Yeah, that's...
Now, the monies come from a government grant and the Ford Foundation?
We get monies from the Office of Education. We get monies from various other foundations, like Ford, Carlisle, John and Mary Markle. We've got money from Exxon. At different times, we've got money through the years from different kinds of...
Because I figure that this, what you're doing here with this Children's Television Workshop is really the first time it's really ever been done right, you know, with so many people involved. And I think I'd like to somewhere show how much it costs to put that all together.
Yeah, I might be able to get those figures for you. One of the things that's... that I think there's several things that are unique about CTW, and I'll tell you what they are. One of the things is that it was the first time in the history of television, that an audience was surveyed and researched prior to the show being developed.
Mm-hmm. To see what they need.
Yeah, to see what the need was. And then, based on that need and addressing itself to that need, developing a whole set of objectives, which I'll share with you. Then, developing a show that would hopefully carry out those objectives in terms of reaching children in a very entertaining and fun fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Something else that's unique in that, as the shows have progressed, unlike other shows which are in the can, Sesame Street has never been. Sesame Street has always been just a few weeks from change.
Mm-hmm.
So that it means that we could delete or add, you know, and change totally the flavor of what was being presented. We have taken all the marvelous techniques, you know, that we see in Madison Avenue advertising techniques and use them on Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm.
We use those techniques to sell letters and numbers and other things. But the other thing that is unique about the shows is that we have advisory groups. We have some of the sharpest educators in the country that have sat in on and lent input into the objectives of our shows, the type of presentation materials of our shows. We have a Spanish advisory committee. We have advisory committee. Every show that we've done, we've got reading experts, we've got preschool experts, and, you know, early childhood experts. And because we're good at one thing, we're really good at producing an entertaining television show. We're television producers. You know, that's basically what we are. We do a lot of in-house research, but we rely too on some objective research that's done through ETS, Educational Testing Service out of Princeton, to help us in assessing and determining, is this working? You know, check this out. We'll run, utilize a given technique in teaching a given objective. And we'll test it on the kids, and we say, gee, that's not working. And we change it, and we use something else. And we're constantly doing that and trying to get the right mix. One of the things that is, another thing that is unique about the shows is the approaches that The very reason for our existence is that children are different. And that if we're going to effectively reach a lot of children, then we have to acknowledge the difference in them and present material in such a way that it will reach the way children respond, because they respond differently because of their differences. There's some children that really relate very well to quiet sequences. So then there are others that love the Muppets and the animated things. And there are others that will relate to the human beings on the show and how they interface. So we will take a given concept and present it within a given show in several different ways, because we're trying to reach all the different children that are viewing. Another thing about the shows is that they're all separate entities. In spite of the fact that there's a lot of continuity, that a youngster that looks at the show once a week will benefit. A youngster looking at the show twice a week or three times a week, that they're not sequential. Okay. You have another question?
Yeah. Okay, I want to get into a whole list of, I would like to have a page in my book, the people who make, you know, the television workshop happen, you know, and then just have a page of all the different companies that have been called in.
Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. That would, you would you probably see, have to get from,
it gets pretty,
from the producers.
It gets pretty hairy, but in this book I like to, in giving people credit, also have it a form of a reference guide, you know? For the first time anywhere, some rank cartoon company that just probably, the only time they ever made it big was on Sesame Street, finally gets some credit and maybe gets a picture of their style of their stuff for you know,
what
change.
I know a lot of it is done here. A lot of the animation comes from California.
Yeah.
I don't know who those people are because I don't really have anything to do with production.
Yeah.
But I'm sure... I know at one time, and I'm not sure just what they're still doing, but we used to get some things done by the committee.
The committee is a...
Yeah.
Wasn't that a comedy group?
Mm-hmm. They used to do some of the animation, though.
Oh, really?
They've contributed. I know that was... I remember that, but that's been a few years back. But I don't know, you know, what other groups or anything that... But I'm sure if you wrote the producers, they would provide you with that.
And if you could help me with that, to who I should write to, that would be helpful.
We have a new producer.
Sesame Street. Now, my next question is that the networks, you know, receive quite a bit of pressure from groups like the PTA and such. Has CTW ever gotten that kind of criticism?
Yes.
How so?
Yes.
What is their criticism?
Well, you know, people look at us like we're a national monument or something, you know, that we've been around as long as the Liberty Bell and the Statue of Liberty, and then, you know, of course that's not true. They also choose to ignore right off the bat that we say we're experimental.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that, you know, whenever I go and talk to groups, first thing I say is that this is an effort. You know, we don't think we're the answer. We just think that maybe we're part of it, and this is a direction, and we're trying to think that...
You're so successful, and you think you're the greatest.
Yeah, and that's not true. And I go out, and I'll tell teachers, and I'll tell parents, and every time I go and talk to a group, and I know this... is the case in other cities as well. We're saying to them, we very much need your input because you're in the home and you see your youngsters' response to what's going on. That we have children that have been involved in testing, you know, in test and research situations. But you as the teacher in the classroom, you're sitting there with your children And you know, like the parents and teachers that told me about the physically handicapped children and their inability to feel a part of Sesame Street because they weren't there. Mm-hmm. I needed that. I don't have physically handicapped children. I don't even know any physically handicapped children. So I had no sensitivity in that area. I just thought the show was neat. And mm-hmm. all children looking at it would see how great it is. Because look, we had little black children, we had Puerto Ricans and, you know, Chinese children. And so,
just right.
Yeah, but you see, the reality was that we feel that it's very important to get this kind of input. But people very often ignore that we're saying that. And they really get it into their heads that we're self-righteous, and we're not at all. If we were, we would say, this is Sesame Street, and that's it, because we know we produced the best show ever, and there's nothing. You know, that's not true. We're saying that we think that we've got a great product, but what makes it great is its ability to change and to incorporate and to include and to, you know, to delete.
Now, if you sent out 1,000 letters to, not teachers, but let's say we sent out 1,000 letters to parents.
Would we get objections?
No. How many responses do you think, let's say you had a poll, just a questionnaire, how many responses do you think, of answers, just to the questionnaire, positive or negative, how many do you think you'd get out of 1,000 in return?
Probably. Well, it's hard to say because, you know.
How responsive are the parents?
They're very responsive. We get lots of response. I was still kind of dealing with the other question in terms of the kinds of things that people have attacked us on.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
A lot of people.
They say your program goes too fast?
Sometimes.
I can't think that quickly? Yeah.
No, what's interesting is that they haven't noticed Sesame Street has slowed down. Mm-hmm. Electric Company is, I mean, if you looked at the first year of Electric Company and then looked at it now.
It's a different age category too, isn't it?
Yeah, but not so much that. I'm talking about the same shows.
Yeah.
I mean, not the same shows, but I mean, the Electric Company, the first year of Electric Company and Electric Company now, and it is totally different. Mm-hmm. It is much, much slower. So, you know, Sesame Street is too. Now the complaints, the real vicious complaints are the ones that really get me. Like, middle-class white people want to know why we use Spanish on the show. And why don't we join the mass of people that insist that Spanish people learn how to speak English? Why should we cater to Spanish people? That's one. Others want to know why we use colloquialisms, you know, like some on the Electric Company where it might be considered ghettoese, you know, why that's included. Others, we got a big knock from Woman's Lib.
Really?
Woman's Lib got us, and I know that we respond to people because one of the things the show has changed is based in response to Women's Lib.
Was it the kind of thing where
they didn't like
wears a dress and the little boy wears pants? Is that
no
that
Susan?
Simple,
they didn't like Susan waiting on Gordon, her husband, and they thought Susan should have a job. Let Gordon get his own damn coffee and give Susan a job. Mm-hmm. And you know the producers of the show kind of laughed a little bit, you know, but then they thought about it, and the reality is, in disadvantaged communities, that when jobs are really tight, in most instances, it's very easy for a woman to go out and get a job. Mm-hmm. You know, so they felt...
So did you get a job in the shop?
She sure did. She has a job. She's a nurse. Of course, a woman's lived one, know why she wasn't a doctor.
Yeah.
But that was in response, and it made sense. Also, we now have some career objectives included in Sesame Street, where we are exposing children to various occupations and trying to make that exposure such that they will not feel that those occupations are for certain races or sexes.
So you can absolutely do anything you want these days, which is true.
Yeah. So that kind of thing we're doing on the show. Mm-hmm. So that's in, you know, that's kind of in response to some of that. I was trying to think some of the things. I mean, some people don't like the number of black people on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are various kinds of, but those are not the real heavy ones. The real heavy ones, are, they don't like that Spanish. And it's, and what it does to me personally is really validates the reason the Spanish is so much needed.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time I go out and hear that, the viciousness of how they attack, well, my parents were Italian and they came to this country and they got a, became a part of the mainstream. And I'm sick and tired of coddling these people and saying that they don't have to learn English. And you can see there's, I mean, they're absolutely angry. And what I tell them, if you draw a circle around this country, that everywhere that circle touches is a tremendous Spanish-speaking community.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago, Boston, New York, Florida, Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
Texas, you know, coming on around, yeah, Arizona, right. Nevada, California, Seattle, you know, you sweep it across. Then you can go like this across the country,
mm-hmm.
and following the migrant stream up from like Texas going through up to Illinois, in there are all these Spanish. I was in Whirling, Wyoming. They had a little town that hardly had people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had them a little, you know, a little Spanish barrio in Whirling, Wyoming. So there is no place in this country where it should, where Spanish is not spoken. And I mean in to a significant degree. So whether we accept it or like it or not, we live in a country that, by all intents and purposes, should, for all intents and purposes, should be bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
That I need Spanish every day in my job.
Yeah.
And I know that many, many people do. But I grew up in California, and I grew up during that period when there was really a stigma attached to speaking Spanish. It was like saying, I'm going to learn how to speak nigger.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to grow up and why would I take Mexican? Who wants to speak? I mean, that was the stigma associated. So I took French and German in school.
Mm-hmm.
Because, gee, it was glamorous to speak French. And everybody knew if you had any kind of, you know, scientific interest at all, you really needed German. But nobody needed the ability to speak Spanish. Well, every single day, I need the ability to speak Spanish. And I could go, you know, a lifetime, unless I decide I'm going to travel, you know, outside of this country, without the ability to speak French or German. You know, so, anyway, that's, those are some of the kinds of things.
I was interviewing Faith Heckman at CBS, and I noticed she had this big rating board, and I don't see a rating board around here. Is that not important to you?
The ratings?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
Or what you're up against it with at the time?
No. We have no competition.
So you don't absolutely worry about what's on at the other time?
We don't worry about numbers. We don't even get involved. We make suggestions. They're prime times for preschoolers looking at television.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. prime time for preschoolers. It's between 7 and 9 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, our show's there then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sesame Street does. We make suggestions and recommendations as to how we, you know, approximate times we'd like them to be here. For example, the electric company, we like to see aired during the school day. We also like to see it aired the previous evening. So what you would see Monday at 5 o'clock would come on the following day at 10 or 11 o'clock
mm-hmm.
during the school day. This would enable teachers to be at home and kind of preview the show and then use it in the classroom the next day.
Helps too once you've heard something twice. It helps you remember
it. Yeah, well, not so much for the children. The electric, I know the main purpose
uh-huh.
of doing it. I mean, it'll be seen. We don't assume that the children are necessarily looking at it twice. What we're hoping is that we pick up an evening audience and a day audience, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is that it means that the teachers will
they can really use more of it than a TV show.
Right. They can do some follow-up. And
so I saw you were sending out some guidelines there. How many of those are sent out to the school? How many schools now do you think are participating with the Sesame Street program, for instance?
Well, Sesame Street's really not an in-school program.
Preschool, but...
Yeah, but we have a lot of schools that use, I don't know, thousands. We send those are by subscription. The ones you see in there are just a handful that we send out, like where I may take to meetings
mm-hmm.
to show people a sample of the kind of follow-up of materials that are available. But those are subscribed through our New York office. People subscribe to our follow-up materials. Anything I have here, like giveaways and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like some of that information.
I'm going to give you that.
I'll
give you some samples.
What I really need also is some pictures. I have some shows here. Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Now, are you involved with that, Mr. Rogers? No, that's just something that's also shown on the...
It's on PBS.
Yeah.
He's not making any more shows.
That's what I understand.
Mm.
But it's still shown, isn't it?
Mm, I think so.
Reebok is something else that I have. The Zoom Electro Company.
That's our show.
And Villa Alegre. That's it. Once Upon a Classic is not yours, and Feeling Free is not yours either. Otherwise, you'd know about that one.
Mm-mm. No, I think I read about that's the show where the children
are handicapped.
Uh huh. And they
have different kinds of handicaps. Some are midgets. Some have hearing disabilities or cannot see.
I saw something. Where did I see that? You said it was in TV Guide?
Yes.
No, I haven't read a TV Guide, so I couldn't have seen it there.
Okay, I asked you earlier, what kind of response do you get if you were to send out 1,000 things? I saw this thing in Television Guide the other day that they sent out 15,000 copies of a response kind of sheet like I had described. And they had a grand total out of 1,500. They got it. 96 parents responded.
Out of 15,000 or 1,500?
What you reading?
Where is this?
It's an interesting article. Well, you mentioned you were doing that work in the prisons. What other projects, do you see in store for the future that you know about?
Oh, we have a lot of projects. That's just one.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we work with the migrants.
Just
I have projects.
Yeah,
I've got projects with the migrants. projects with Native Americans. I've traveled to the reservation and do workshop and training sessions there. I'm going to be doing a summer project with the Native American tribes around Escondido, mm-hmm. down by San Diego. We have projects where we have worked with senior citizen groups, trained them to be tutors. We have, I guess, the bulk of what we're involved in ongoing is in-service training for teachers. We have had projects through major universities where their students have received credit for being tutors and so forth and working in mm-hmm. developing centers. We have projects in libraries and Head Starts and daycare centers using Sesame Street Electric mm-hmm. Company.
What would you like to see happen in the future that's not happening now? I mean, if you could get your foot in the door and make some kind of change or some kind of wish something could happen, what would you like to see?
In terms of television?
Yeah.
For children?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. So glad you asked. I don't think I'm talking, well, let me just put it this way. I have another concern, and that is that in this country, there are many, many people that feel alienated, do not feel a sense of patriotism, a sense of citizenship, you know. Maybe for you, because you came from another country, it's very different. I don't know. Most people that have become citizens.
California boy.
Yeah, well, you've been here for so long.
Yeah.
But people that have come to this country as adults and gone through the citizenship
yeah.
program, those people are like, you know, they're really talking about God and country, boy. They're ready to do it. But there is a lack of feeling of that. And there are many reasons for it. You know, there are times when I don't particularly feel very patriotic in terms of some of the values
mm-hmm.
that I know this country truly stands for. And I don't care what anybody, the BS that they hand you. But we are all, whether we like it or not, we are citizens of our home, citizens of our block, our neighborhood, our community, our city, our state, our country, and the world. And is the world citizenship, you know, that I'm most concerned about. I think that television is a very viable way to make children feel a sense of being a world citizen. You can label it all kinds of things, one nation, this, or
and you see all the problems
matter.
In the world, but the ones you have at home seem
very small.
Yeah.
When you see that children in another country have similar aspirations, you know, when you think you're involved in struggle and you think your life is very negative, like the children in this country, they have no idea what it is to live in a country where there's been continuous war.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a sensitivity. Now, the concern is not so that kids just know this, but that through that knowledge would precede them develop into adults that have some care and people that start to say that, gee, what I do here affects people in other places, that I can't think of myself as a separate entity. You know, I can go in my house and turn up my radio as loud as I please, but when I do that, I better be aware that I'm also affecting my neighbor, that we can get in this this country and say, well, we'll use all the electricity we damn well please because this is a free country. You know, we'll use up all these resources, and we use, I guess, more resources. We're using, I guess, the equivalent of what half the rest of the world is using just mm-hmm. here in this very tiny, tiny country. Mm-hmm. Because we're affluent, and we just feel like, so what? Mm-hmm. You know, but when you feel like a citizen of that world community, you start thinking in terms of how your actions affect the lives of other people, just as you would consider other people when you're playing your radio in an apartment building or in your house. You start thinking in terms of, when I dissipate the resources here, then it's going to affect these other people. And what I want to see is, I have great interest in people becoming more aware of how we are interdependent upon each other. You know, there's cycles of life. Okay, there's the time that when we're born, when we're very dependent. And then there's this time when we kind of sow our oats and we feel like, gee, you know, I can do it by myself, Mom. You know, I'm an individual. And then we come to a point that is probably the greatest demonstration of maturity, is when we recognize that though we are independent, we are also interdependent, you know. That it is very important to consider, you know, the necessity of my accepting what you have to offer, mm-hmm. and for my being a person that is capable of giving you something in return. And I just think that in itself would go a long ways in terms of dealing with world peace. And I think that the media, you know, is probably the most viable means that we have of transmitting that message. So, and that is world citizenry, you know. Mm-hmm. And it starts in a neighbor-to-neighbor thing, but I just think that we don't get enough examples of people caring. You know, we have sister cities. I'll pick up the newspaper and I'll read where they're talking about the mayor went to visit the sister city. Mm-hmm. But I really don't have any idea, you know. I know that there are all kinds of...
I visited my sister city in Germany, you know, Woodier.
Oh, uh-huh, that kind of... But I'm wondering, you know, do we, as individuals, do we feel a sense of responsibility? You know, I can't really tell you. And, you know, Los Angeles has, I don't know how many sister cities. I cannot tell you one of them. And then tell you, in exchange, how, if we are part of a mutual family, what portion of responsibility I have personally assumed mm-hmm. for them.
Yeah, they're so busy doing their own work.
Yeah.
Caring that they,
okay, so I think this out. Could yeah. be done in a television show. Yeah. I think very exciting. I mean, spotlighting.
You can be in a country like that.
Yeah, spotlighting how neighbors help neighbors, mm-hmm. how individuals help communities, how individuals can make a difference in government. You know, I think we've gotten very pessimistic, you know, in our view of what we can do in terms of government. I think people have been very turned off, you know, from participating in government. They're saying they're all crooks and they're all this, which is probably true to a great extent. But at the same time, that's all the more reason that people need to participate and to be aware, and not to say, well, gee, it doesn't matter to me. Like I told you, I don't have In our family, we have no physically handicapped, or we don't have any retardation that we can, that is noted on record anywhere. I think sometimes my children act like they're a little retarded, but it doesn't mean that I as a person can allow myself to be indifferent toward those people that are. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're, I don't have this neat little perfect world that I can sit in and put my children inside of and say, okay, in this world, I'm not going to worry, I don't have to worry about those people that are poor, because in our world, there are no poor people. You know, I don't have to worry about the physically handicapped, because in our world, everybody is physically perfect and beautiful. I don't have to worry about the people that can't read, because all the people in our world are intellectual giants. That's unrealistic. And it is the same premise. The same thing applies to when you're talking about, I'm not going to worry about what's going on in Ireland, because, hell, that's a long way over there. I'm not going to worry about what's going on in South Africa, because that doesn't affect me. I'm not going to worry about what happens in here or there, whatever. You know, that, gee, that was tragic, but it doesn't affect me. Well, we can't. You know, that indifference is part of the eroding process of our humanness, you know. And every time we're able to dismiss something, that's a little bit of, that's a, you know, it's like the Grand Canyon and the etching away of whatever it is that makes us human as opposed to a lower animal life. And it's almost like we're neutralizing ourselves every time we do that. And in some ways, television has contributed to that process. And maybe that's a real negative about it. You know, I remember talking to some friends of mine that were looking at television during the Vietnam War. And they're eating. I mean, they didn't stop eating, you know, and they could look at all those atrocities. And it was kind of like they were looking at Disney on parade. It had,
it's, you know, like you're watching Beretta.
Yeah, it was like, that doesn't, that's not real. That's fantasy. That doesn't exist. Whereas if you say, if you
watch television for 8 hours, you kind of desensitize.
I've heard people talk more about, like, get more upset about a kid saying something about, oh, I threw up today. And they still talk about things like that at the table. Don't you know better? You know, or a youngster saying something about, guess what? I found a dead cat or something. Don't say that. I mean, they're busy dealing with that as being, but they're saying they're looking at piles of bodies. Yeah. And I mean, there is no horror.
Yeah.
You know, and how you're saying, wait a minute, what kind of human being are you? You know, where is all this marvelous Christian ethic, you know, that this country is supposed to portray and symbolize? It's a lot of bullshit, you know. So the only way that I think that this can come back is to begin with the children. Because I just dismiss adults. I mean, trying to change adults is very difficult. Probably impossible.
What you're saying with television is you can either use it or abuse it, and that's one way to...
I think that because the honest presentation of things does not necessarily get an appropriate response, that you have to do something deliberately to bring about a response and to elicit the humanness in people. You know, I was looking at, you know, like sometimes you look at a really good movie and they milk you to death because they really get you hooked. You know, you get awesome, and I'm a crier, you know. I get really moved to tears. Oh, isn't that something? The mother came home, or, you know, and somebody's been looking for the long lost. Yeah, that whole bit. Well, if television can do that, you know, over some little petty nothing, then certainly they could use that to try to draw that kind of response from you in terms of your dealing with people.
Yeah. To make some kind of constructive.
Of course, now we're moving into a time when we're going to be able to feed back to television. And that's going to be a biggie, too. You know, that those cable systems where you can respond to what's going on television. And I think maybe, hopefully then, we might get something. I don't think parents are indifferent. I just think that if they had verbally put that on television, I don't think people read. I don't think it's not an indication of indifference. It's an indication that they just don't read that article.
People don't need to. What do you mean, this?
They probably never even got down to that part. They probably thought, and then they procrastinate. They probably said, yeah, that's really nice. But, you know, if they had said that this is threatened and that, you know, they're going to forbid us to have this kind of activity and we're doing this in spite of the law after us, then you get some, because the people would be angry and they'd respond negatively. People always do that. It's very hard to get a positive response, you know, from anybody. Because, I mean, there are things that I see. I clip articles and sometimes I say, I'm going to drop them a note or I'm going to do this. And I kind of clip them and fold them and tuck them somewhere. And it doesn't quite get responded to. Well, don't let me see something in the paper that angers me or that I am totally opposed to, then I don't care what doesn't get done. I'm going to sit down and deal with this issue, you know. So I'm not sure whether that's a true indicator of, you know, parental interest in the viewing of the children. I always think that's kind of ridiculous, though. I think that I don't understand how people raise their children. You know, I raised mine like a dictator. You know, if I felt like something was on television they shouldn't see, I got them turned it off. If I felt like it was a movie that they should not go to see, then I didn't take them. And I saw to it that nobody else took them. You know, if I don't censor that much because I don't really believe in censorship, but if I did, you know, it would not be. I think that when a parent tells me that they're concerned about what's on television and how it's affecting their four-year-old, I wonder what's affected them. You know, where are you? You can't control a four-year-old? You can't determine? I mean, if you can't control a four-year-old, I mean, you're going to have a 16 or 17-year-old that's bopping you around the room.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.